This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, so podcast number five. So I'm very privileged to be here in the Pete Whittaker's house. So, and it's early in the morning. Is it like 9 o'clock? I had to get up.
Yeah, 9:30.
I had to get up early to get here. Pete lives in this like palatial mansion. It's just, he's got climbing holes that run from one side of his open plan house to the other. And there's sex swings. There's everything in here. Actually, it's probably just the most. No, I was going to say it's like a. I won't say anything disparaging, but it's exactly where you'd imagine a climber from Sheffield to be living. Really, it's in this tiny little box on top of a hill.
Yeah, I chose a hill because of the flooding in Sheffield.
Oh yeah, because yeah. I used to live about 500 meters away, like over in Mearsbrook, in the Muesli. This is the Muesli Belt, isn't it? This area.
I have no idea.
Yeah, the Muesli Belt. Everyone eats Muesli here.
Yeah, we do.
So Pete's given me a really shit cup of tea with some kind of lactate from a bean or something. Or some kind of weird, you know. Yeah. What's it called?
Pressed oats. Oats, whatever. It's watery oats.
If you don't drink proper milk, I reckon you'll be 10 times better. So maybe we should start this. I had an interesting thought this morning.
Yeah.
So I said to Pete this morning, should I bring you a cup of tea? Good job I didn't, because you would have been like vomiting because it would have real milk in it. And remember this story, you might have heard this story before, but like Johnny Dawes, the not late but still great Johnny Dawes, he used to be friends with Al Rouse, the mountaineer Al Rouse. He used to live in Netheredge somewhere, and Johnny used to just go around to his house and he would let himself in. And he would like make a cup of tea, and he would go upstairs and he would like jump into bed with Al Rouse. I don't think anything went on, but he used to jump into bed with Al Rouse. And Al Rouse was always away. And Al Rouse eventually died on like K2, was it 1984 or something? Anyway, so he eventually died. But he was always going away on trips. So when he was back, like Johnny would go around, let himself in, make 2 cups of tea, come upstairs. So one day, like Johnny heard that Al Rouse was back from like an expedition. So he went out to his house. Like opened the door like early in the morning, went in, made these 2 cups of tea, like went upstairs, opened the door, and when the door opened, there's these two terrified looking strangers sat in Al Rouse, laid in this Al Rouse's bed, and Johnny was like, didn't know what was going on. And what I didn't realize was that Al Rouse had sold his house
while
he'd been away, because the door was, then were the days, the 80s, you know, we didn't lock our doors. So these two people just had this person downstairs making cups of tea and knocking around, and then there was like Johnny Dawes standing there. So
classic.
Yeah. So I didn't want to do that. I thought I'd avoid, you know, I'd just knock on the door instead.
Yeah, you can't come in the front anyway.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You would have had to, I don't know, pick the lock on the side
door. Yeah, there's loads of like Argos magazines and Argos
exactly.
Catalogues piled against the front door.
Yeah.
What have we got? Does it look like? It looks like a, I guess the Persichet house with us, another man, I guess.
It is.
Yeah, I can just sort of tell. You know. It's not got that woman, very sexist. You know, that hasn't got the woman's that woman's touch.
Has it not?
No. Like it's not sexist if it's true. So, so what do you want to talk to me about?
I don't know. You've come here. You've come here. You asked me. I don't know. What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. Really, I don't like to think about these things. I don't think about ahead too far ahead. I guess what I remember the first time I actually properly met you, like I'd seen you around. Oh my God, there's Pete Whittaker. Oh my God, you know. And I thought he'd be bigger. You know, that's have you ever?
Be bigger.
No, do you ever,
taller.
You ever seen Roadhouse? With no. Patrick Swayze.
No.
We always have to have a Roadhouse reference in a lot of these podcasts. But you need to go and watch. Are you one of these climbers who's never seen any television or films or anything?
I don't have a television. No, I don't watch television. And I've seen a few films, but I'm not much of a film or television person.
Do you get do you get easily distracted? Do you have to go and do some pull-ups or something?
No, it's not that. I just always feel like I have something else to do.
And what's your favourite film?
Favourite film? Oh.
Frozen?
No, that's Tom's favourite film. Tom loves that.
Oh God. Yeah. He's got kids. You
know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't know. What's your favourite film?
I'm asking the questions.
Yeah, you answer.
If you're on a plane and it's like, oh great, look this film's on.
Yeah, I'd just go for the new ones. I'd just go for the new releases.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't really matter what there is.
Are you gonna go see the new Star Wars film?
Probably not, no.
Is there a new Star Wars film?
Huh?
Is there a new Star Wars film? No.
Is there? No, but is there?
Yeah.
Is there? Yeah, yeah. I don't know. No. I probably won't go and see it though.
So this is actually telling us a lot about your character. That's interesting. That we'll get to this later on about why you are who you are. But in Roadhouse, you know, Patrick Swayze is just like, try and make some time to watch Roadhouse. Maybe I'll send you it on. It's on Netflix. We have got telly, so you get to watch it. But next time you're in Norway, I bet in Roadhouse will be really big in Norway. It's probably called like Roadhausen or something. So when you go there, they'd be like, ah, Roadhausen. But they're not German. So but anyway, in Roadhouse, whenever Patrick Swayze, who's this like really kick-ass guy, who's like kung fu, zen master kind of person, every time people meet him, they're like, oh, I thought you'd be bigger, like every time someone meets him. Anyway, so...
Well, that's what you thought.
Oh, God, they'd be bigger. I thought you'd be smaller. Do you know when people are like Leah Holding, they're always like 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Or like Leonardo DiCaprio, like, you know, you imagine he's always this like young lad, and then, but you forget that he's actually growing, you know, like he's actually growing at the same age that you are. Like, how old are you now, Leo? It's like 35. You're like, what? But you were only like 16.
How old is he now? 30.
Is he getting, he must be getting towards 40. 40. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's midlife crisis time.
Mm.
And everyone seems to have a midlife crisis at the moment. I bet you won't have one.
A midlife crisis?
Yeah, mm-hmm. You don't seem the type.
When does it hit and what is it? give me a briefing so it doesn't happen.
Patrick Swayze, thought you'd be bigger. Yeah, so I'd seen you around, like, oh my God, that's Pete Whittaker. And then I guess there's a point in any sport where there's all these like young whippersnappers who are like pushing the limits, aren't they? And there's the old guard who are like, I wasn't the old guard, I was working the shop probably. But there's all the old guard who are like, oh, in my day, we didn't have chalk or we didn't have cams and all that kind of bullshit. But they seem to then like thin out. Like some of them just stop climbing, do other things. And some of them just have this like sustain and keep on going. So if you think of like, Leo, you had like Patch and you had all these other climbers who were still doing it, but they're not doing it to the same
degree. And they're doing other things now, I guess, as
They start to surfing or get a girlfriend or whatever, or get a boyfriend, you know, if they're a girl. Anyway, I'm trying not to be one of these people. I'm trying to not correct my thoughts all the time when I'm speaking.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, I just said... What's wrong? Like I had a photograph the other day and I said this, I did an illustration and I said, this was like two guys humping.
I saw that.
And someone was like, what's wrong with that? And I was like, oh, automatically was like, oh, as long as they're consenting adults. And I was like, fuck it, like, who cares? Like, it's just a picture. Anyway, so getting off. It's too early in the morning for doing this. But so you were someone who, like, I remember, like, watching you doing, like, Baron Greenback.
Mm.
And I was just like, and I was just like, I'm not really a rock climber, but I was just like, fucking hell, like, that is someone, like, just this amazing, I don't know if talent, I think talent is one of his words that actually encompasses, like, huge amount of stuff. But it was just like this kind of desire, not a desire, you're just going to make this thing happen.
Mm.
Like this sheer force of will. You may not know you've got it, but it's just this ability to sort of warp time and space and make something happen. Like you are going to get that hold, or you are going to stand up on this thing. And I think that's probably the thing that separates, like, great climbers from shit climbers, from really great climbers, are these ones like, you know, Jerry Moffat, this thing. Someone told me Jerry Moffat, you know, he always made everything look really hard, no matter how easy it was. Like, you just, like, but you had to, like, almost, like, rip him off the rock, because he was just, like, and Alan Mullen, I remember him telling me this route, it was, like, a grade 8 Scottish mixed route. He was, like, you'd literally have to want to jump off to fall off it, you know, but anybody else would be really struggling on it. But this mentality of just like, I can do this, I'm going to do this, and there's no, like, doubt. So I remember seeing that, I'm like, wow, this is someone who's got some kind of superhuman talent here. I don't want to make you all blush over everything else. But then and then I watched, like, Wide Boys, and then when I watched Wide Boys, I remember thinking that in a way, like, Tom was like the grafter. Like, he is, like, in a way you can relate more to Tom, because Tom might have huge amount of talent and everything else, but you're so talented and so effortlessly talented that it just makes him look a bit shit, even though he's doing the same things that you're doing, but he looks like he's always struggling to, like,
Tom is a grafter.
Yeah,
he works hard,
but he really puts the thought in, he puts in the pro, it's part of the process.
Yeah, I think it is, yeah.
Where you
yeah,
just seem to, like, wander off, you know, like,
I'm not sure about that.
Pick up a guitar and just like Jimi Hendrix, like, oh,
no, my fingers are too fat for the guitar anyway. It's awful, I press all the strings, can't do it.
So watch that film, and I was like, I really like if anyone's not seen Wide Boys, you should watch it. But it's probably one of the best films of that period, I think, because it just has this amazing British kind of shitness in it. It's just, you know, these two guys in a cellar, you know, like, just making it. It's like what's that thing, Full Monty or something?
Oh yeah,
like a climbing Full Monty. It's just like this kind of like, the underdog, which I think British people like.
Mm.
In fact, people fear the underdog where you fail, you know, but you give it a good go. They don't like it when you succeed. It's a bit like, that's a bit up themselves to actually get, you know. And I think all the like Full Monty, I reckon they all were done for, like, benefit cheating, you know, and then lost their benefits and were all homeless afterwards, after the film had finished. But I remember watching that film and, like, going, like, this is, like, the perfect film, the way it's constructed, and the characters, and you go there and you do it. And I just remember that brilliant bit where Stevie Haston, he's probably the most terrifying human being in the planet. And that, you know, to begin with, he's like, you can just see this, like, he really fucking hates you. Like, he's like, you know, and then at the end, he kind of gives you, like, a half-hearted congratulations. but I remember watching that. And then I think you emailed me sometime and you were like, I want to get into, like, speaking or something.
Mm.
So I met you down at the work station in Sheffield, and I was like, I think I was, like, really blown away, like, how you were the most, like, humblest man, you know. When's he coming? And you're like, no, that's me, you know. I'm Pete. And how I think it's how little you seem to realize how talented you are. This is like a fucking blowjob. This thing, isn't it? No, but you meet people and they have so much talent. And I've met I met a few people at the same time, like Tessa Lyons and people like that, who were, like, really, really talented, but they just didn't seem to get it. You know, they're, like, working in a coffee shop.
Yeah.
And they were, like, this brilliant person who they would only really fully engage with this talent when they just engage with it.
Yeah.
But it was just like a sideline, like, oh yeah, I'm a you know, I'm a tree surgeon and I do rock climbing as well. Like, I remember saying to you, how do you make a living? And you're like, how much money do you get from Patagonia? And you're like, I don't get any money from Patagonia. And I was like, what? Like, you were like probably one of the top climbers in the world at the time. And you still are, like, in terms of exposure and what you're doing. And you weren't getting like really any support from, you got some money from like, don't want to go into your finances, from Wild Country, whatever. But remember, I like, just this being like, just get, I think it's forget about the public speaking, you know, just focus on what you're really good at. And I think you were saying, I'm going to go to, this is just a podcast and I'm talking for the whole time.
Sorry, I'll just,
we'll get to it in a minute. You'll remember a few words anyway. But, I think you were, I was like, what's your plans? And you were like, oh, I'm going to go to Yosemite in like 2 years time or something. It was something. And you're just like, what are you doing, Pete? So, well, you seem to, after like smash your head against the table, you know, you seem to have sorted yourself out a bit more. Is that true?
So that's the question.
That's a lot of question. Have you sorted yourself out? Do you realize how talented you are?
Yeah, well, I guess from when I first met you then, that must have been probably when I was 23 or something.
Was that 2014 maybe?
Yeah, it was a while back. But yeah, I was still doing tree surgery work, and I was still doing root setting work, and I was still trying to like mix it in with doing like hard objectives and hard climbing and all that kind of stuff. But then I think over the last 5 years, more stuff has picked up with my climbing, and then I've gradually been able to sort of drop the other things. But I never actually went like, oh, now I'm gonna be a professional climber or whatever. It was more just like a gradual thing. And like 2.5 years ago, at the start of the year or something, I just said, oh, I'm not gonna do any more tree surgery work anymore. And then when you cut something out, actually like you, like other things come your way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then you're able to say yes to things. And then when you say yes to things, then, you know, you get more things from that. And then at the end of last year, because I was still doing root setting up to the end of last year. And then to the end of last year, I was just like, oh, well, I'm going to stop root setting now. So it's actually only this year where it's been, everything I've done has been fully related to my climbing.
Yeah. You know, and how old are you now?
28.
Yeah.
So it's actually only been that 1 year. So it's been more of like a gradually stopping doing the things that you would class as more normal jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then going into the things which you would class as not quite as normal, but just like picking up things along the way.
Do you think you're living life like on your terms? Like you're doing it very gradually. You know, you're very conservative in the way you're approaching it, aren't you really?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I'm probably just quite careful. I don't really, I do jump at things, but I don't, but I like think about it first.
Like my sister was a teacher and she really hated it. And she just, you know, one of these schools where it's a great school and suddenly you get a new head and everything just falls apart. And she was so stressed. And I remember saying to her, like, just give your job up and jump and the net will appear. And I said it's a joke, like jump and the net will appear. And then she gave her job up and she ended up getting this, probably even a worse job, but she likes it.
Fishing job.
The fishing shop. And but I remember I saying like about 4 years later, like, oh yeah, when you said like jump and the net will appear, like I really thought that was like, that's what I had to do. And I was like, I was joking. It's like one of these things you see on a poster in a crap motivational thing. But maybe so, I guess you're...
Maybe you were joking to me.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. But maybe, yeah. Maybe you're jumping, but it's like, how well's the net attached and what kind of net is it? Like, yeah. You know, like you're...
I've been gradually jumping. It's been a very, very slow... It's a slow jump. Yeah, it's like one of those slow motion things. The camera's been on slow motion. Yeah.
Because I guess some people do make that... You know, if you're you want to be a filmmaker or you want to be a writer, and they go like 100% into it, but they have they've done none of the groundwork, and eventually they just run out of money or they just fail and they have to go back to another job. Can you pay your mortgage just via climbing?
Yeah,
of this beautiful house.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all the other stuff I do as well. Like, I've been doing these crack school coaching, and I've started up doing this white boy's business and
yeah.
selling those things and doing some more speaking work actually as well.
Yeah.
So I think sort of like, yeah, I think sort of like everything combined.
Yeah.
And then along with some better sponsorship deals and,
yeah.
And all that kind of stuff.
I bet you're a disaster when it comes to like getting sponsorship. Like you probably go for the meeting and they're like we're going to give you £50 and you're like, oh, really, that much? Oh, I don't know if I'm worth it, you know? So when you meet like American climbers, I know American climbers like differently. I think when I was sponsored by Patagonia, I used to get like, I think it was like 2,000 euros a year or something.
Mm.
And then I met someone in America and I didn't even know who they were and they were getting like 20,000.
Mm.
And you just realise that the just like living in the US or living somewhere else, it's so different.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the UK is it's a massive market, outdoor market. And I think they do actually exploit climbers and people, especially people where they're like, if you're just a great climber, like I don't see why you should sponsor someone just because they're a good climber.
Yeah.
But when they're a really good ambassador for your brand and for climbing, like you're like the perfect, like you've not got any sexual assault charges, you've not got any, you know, drug addictions or anything else. You don't spite a lot of, you know, you're a very safe pair of hands for a brand. And, you know, I think it's always been that way in Britain. You can just get away with it. Like, we'll give you some free clothes, you know, which the value to the brand is like tiny. You know, you're doing them a favor by wearing their clothes. It's not the other way around.
Yeah.
And I think, I remember like in the 80s, John Dunn and people were saying about we have to have like a former union of climbers.
Mm.
And I think maybe those days are coming back again, really. Because I think we have this misapprehension that, oh, outdoors stuff, it's not a big market. Well, I think the UK is one of the biggest markets in Europe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like UK, Germany, places.
I think for me, I've sort of just like built it up over time. So, yeah. And I haven't been really like jumping from brand to brand.
Yeah.
And I've sort of, you know, I've been with Patagonia since I was like 16, 17.
Yeah.
And now I'm 28. That's like, I'm getting on for 10, well, it's over 10 years, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And like same with Wild Country and
yeah,
like same with 510 and stuff. And I think like Britain compared to America, probably in terms of some of the sponsorship deals that you can get, I always feel like it's maybe a little bit easier in the States.
Yeah, yeah.
Potentially.
Because you meet some of those really good climbers in America and they own like, they'll give this kind of zen like, oh, I sleep under a tree. But they actually own like four houses.
Yeah.
And yeah. So they're making like a shit ton of money. And often they're not as good as, you know, you're going over there and you're besting what they're doing. But you just...
You never really know what anybody's getting though, do you? Because nobody really talks about it. So.
No.
But I think for me, I've sort of like built it up over time. And I've built a good relationship up with the brands that I've worked with. And, you know, I sort of trust them and they trust me. And it's not like I've just said like, I'm going to be a professional climber and then being like contacted this brand and then being like, I want 10 grand a year. I want 20 grand a year.
Yeah, you know,
it's actually just been like a little bit at a time and then gradually like filtering out the other work.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then gradually building up that. And it's never been like punching in with like massive figures. It's gradually just like,
does it also allow you to like step back? Cause you know, if you like it. So I think the modern, when I talk to my kids about how, not you, my child, when I talk to my kids about how to make a living in the future, I always tell them you have to be more like a hunter-gatherer. You can't be this like, this single, you know, you have this one skill. So my daughter's doing like maths at university, mathematics, maths at university. And I'm like saying like, just like, yeah, you're really interested in statistics, but your brain's like an engine and you just have to, you can apply that engine to anything, and you don't think yourself, I'm going to go and get this like public service job in statistics, and as I say, you have to know like more like a hunter gatherer. So like for you now, if you know suddenly like Patagonia went bust or whatever, or the climbing hole business, you know, went down, you have all the, you can actually just go somewhere else.
Yeah, I feel like I have lots of different things going on, and also like trying out lots of different things. So if somebody says, like, come and do this or try this, whatever it might be, then I'm kind of sort of like keen to just give it a go
yeah.
and see what happens. It's like with I'm actually doing like a full speaking tour with Speakers from the Edge.
All right. Oh, yeah.
This year. And I've done like a lot of speaking over the last few years now.
Yeah.
But like that would be something. A little bit new, and it'll be like, I'm kind of psyched, and it'll be good.
You really? I think you're one of these. I made this joke about Ben Moon to somebody. Like, I was just hanging around with all these really fucking, you know, like intense people. You know, like at this, you know, go to a film festival, all these like really intense people, really artistic. And then Ben Moon like wanders in, and I was like, you could like put, I think I actually told him actually, so hopefully if he listens to this, I'm not being offensive. But I said, you could basically scribble Ben Moon down onto a post-it note, because he is exactly who you think he is. There's no stuff going on, you know, not in a negative. But he is just like he always seems like a very stable person. And I think you're kind of the same. it's quite a big post-it note. But you are exactly who we think you are, the general public. Like when we meet you at the Crag, you're not like, oh, I met Pete and I really like this video, but he was a bit of an asshole when I met him. You are what you are on the, what it says on the tin. Because there are people where someone says, oh, have you ever met ex-climber, and like, yeah, everyone loves him till they meet him. And it's kind of true, really. Like, some people, they're very good at like projecting this version of themselves.
Yeah.
And I think when you go on the stage, to be yourself,
yeah,
is so important. Yeah. Some people are so bad at it. Like, you know,
I've got a few ideas.
Have you seen some bad slideshows and things in your time?
I've been to like a whole bunch of slideshows, and you know, they've all been good, a mixture of good and bad.
Yeah.
It's been good to like, obviously it's good to go into like not so good ones as well, because then you sort of pick up on like what not to do.
I remember seeing Hazel Finley do a slideshow in a Kendall Film Festival, and I remember like emailing afterwards and saying like, oh, just as soon as my job is like helping people do slideshows, I'm doing slideshows. I wonder if you wanted some feedback. And she was like, no, I don't want any feedback.
Not really.
Yeah. And I thought kind of fair enough, in that she wanted to find her own way, what worked. And some of it was like, don't have like slides on a white image or whatever, or just little things like get all your images like super solid, you know, and that kind of stuff. And I think she has like, she's like found her own way of doing it, and I think that's interesting, is just sometimes when you're offered advice, sometimes it's like, don't tell, you know, it's like sometimes it's like their ego, like, don't tell me how to do it, and other times it's like, I'll just work it out.
I think you just got to take things from that you see from everybody and then sort of apply it to yourself, but do it.
You can be like Tony Robbins, you go on there like doing kung fu.
I think you just got to do it in your own way and what you're comfortable with doing, haven't you? Because if you try and do it like somebody else, and you're not comfortable with doing that, then it's going to be a bit crap, isn't it?
What's that word when you're genuine? Not some of the word for genuine. It's a big thing these days when you're sponsoring someone, they want to be like bona fide. Oh, I've got such bad weird memory stuff. What's that word? What's that word when you can't remember words? Anyway, but I think you have that again. Another compliment. We'll get to the stuff where I like break you down later on. Like, yeah. Fucking idiot. So you seem to have sorted out your. You're in a good place.
I feel like it. Last year, I would say, has been. That's been a really good year. It's in terms of both like personal climbing, and in terms of like all the jobs and all the other things that go around climbing.
Yeah.
And I think both have been the best year in what I've ever done. I mean, I've like brought a book out as well, so that's quite cool.
Don't talk us. It's like when I'll be on Russell Harty, you're like, oh yeah, I just want to talk about my book. Yeah, I'll bring out an album.
We're not going to talk about it.
Well, I only saw your book like two days ago, first time, and it kind of proves my point about this engine. Like, you're actually one of these people where as soon as you apply whatever's in that head, that post-it note brain of yours. Like, you're one of the people who's probably good at bloody everything and really annoying. Like, you're just like, oh yeah, I did all the electrics in my house, but I'd never done it before. But your book, like, I think it's already pretty successful, even though it's not come out yet. I think they've sold shitloads of copies of it.
Yeah,
it's come out in America. So it's called Crack.
It's just called Crack Climbing. Crack Climbing. nothing fancy.
Because there's another, I remember ages ago, you were like,
we spoke about it,
a book about crack climbing. Yeah. And I was like being negative. I was like, oh, there's already a book called Crack.
It's like, quite useful though, because I think I would have found it anyway.
But, yeah. There's another really good, but I think all these things, like a book's just come out, a big wall climbing book, and you never ever think like, oh, someone else has done it, I won't do it.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Because there's like lots of books about shagging or like about love, and there's lots of porn, you know. But there's like plenty out there. So, but yeah, I remember saying like, oh, there's another book about crack climbing and it's like super detailed. But then when I saw your book, like you've just taken it to the next level, where John Barton is like, I don't understand anything he's talking about. but you know, it's like, he's like gone to like the atomic level of crack climbing.
Yeah.
And so crack climbing is weird, isn't it? Because it's not really, it is like an art, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's probably why it's very like technical form of climbing, I think.
Yeah.
And it's like when I've been doing these crack schools, you can see people who've never climbed on a crack before, and they're not like strong or amazing climbers, but after an hour and a half of coaching, they're like, when you show them the technique and show how it works and explain how it works, they can actually, you know, even just after an hour and a half, they're just like up and
what's the big mistake,
but don't tell anybody, they should really easy, like.
what's the big mistake people make,
the biggest mistake?
Yeah.
Somebody asked me this in a written interview actually recently, and I said that it was actually a really common mistake when I'm teaching these classes, is that it sounds really stupid, but people aren't actually putting the body part fully into the crack that they're trying to jam with,
right?
You know, it's like hanging half out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they wonder why they're sort of like falling out the crack, and you know, you try and do a hand jam and the whole hand isn't even in the crack.
Or yeah,
you try and do an arm bar and they haven't got like
they're not really thinking it like that way. Yeah, you've done some ice climbing now, haven't you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah,
like I think the big thing mistake people make with ice climbing and mixed climbing,
yeah, you've got any tips.
They don't like fully weight their ice axes. You know, like when you're ice climbing, you need to be like hanging off your ice axes to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, people are like really afraid that their ice axe is going to pull out.
Mm.
It doesn't work. And I remember we met you.
Because they're not like pulling down and they're
sort of, yeah, like, pulling, they're not like fully weight, because they're just afraid it's going to pull out.
Yeah, yeah.
And often by not weighting it, it does pull out because it's kind of half engaged or whatever.
Half and half.
What's that thing of a committed foot never slips?
Oh yeah,
that's probably not true, though, is it?
Weighted foot never slips.
Yeah, I always like to think that's true, but that's probably not true. Not when you're on that one, your foot's next to your hand.
No.
Like, I remember meeting you in Squamish,
yeah,
and took you out for a fancy meal. Seem to remember.
Did we?
Oh no, I made you some. I made you some slop in the pan.
No, I think you just thought I was lonely. Homeless, yeah. I was lonely and homeless. I got Squamish by myself.
Yeah.
I didn't have any friends.
Oh, you also only soloed. You soloed like three routes in a day.
Yeah.
And that was like preparing for the...
For El Cap.
Yeah, you were turning up like, Andy, how do you do this? How do you tie it? Oh, Christ, Pete.
I'd read your book, though.
Yeah.
I'd read your book by then.
Book, I think the first version of that book had loads of mistakes in it. Like, the diagram didn't work. I think it was like a slippery hitch, and I think the diagram wasn't right, so people were trying to get it to work and it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
I've noticed that doing the illustration, because you've done some illustrations as well, is that people look at things like you just draw like a random knot. There's not actually a real knot, not important.
Yeah.
And people are like,
what? People are looking at it.
Yeah, like, oh, that knot, what kind of knot is that? And you're like, it's just a knot, it's not a knot. And it's like, oh yeah, but so yeah, people are like, one line is in the wrong place, like one 5-centimeter line is in the wrong place, and the whole thing doesn't work.
Mm.
And it's, anyway, so I remember meeting you, and Vanessa was like learning to crack climb, my wife Vanessa, and she was literally like in tears, like, how can it be so, like a 5-7 crack, how can it be so hard? And like literally in tears. But it was amazing how quickly people just, you know, if you were doing like crimping up some overhanging, you know, limestone wall, it would take you like months and months and months to get good at it. But within like two or three times, and I think maybe at my level of crack climbing, I think the thing people forget is it's all about your feet. It's not about it's not about your hands. And people often wear the wrong kind of, you know, like Vanessa would wear like Anastasia Velcro.
Totally wearing the wrong size, the wrong style of shoe. Yeah. You know, and they've got like their sport climbing downturns on.
Yeah.
And then
they're
trying to, you know, it's like really high profile on the end of the foot, and then they're trying to get it in the crack, and it's like, you know, it's not good.
Do you see that? Like when you, I think the book's going to become like one of those books that everyone's going to have, and wherever you go, people are going to know you about that book rather than about all the climbing.
I reckon. Maybe, I don't know.
You'd be like the crack guy, and the people, oh, Pete, has this ever taped up right? And what do you think a crack jam is? And all that kind of stuff.
I'm quite psyched that, I mean, a lot of the sort of more advanced techniques in the book, like they didn't really have any names, some of the things that I was describing. Yeah. So it was quite fun. I actually like had to make up a load of names. So it'd be interesting to see in like 2, 3, 4 years time or something, whether you're out in Indian Creek and you just hear somebody like, oh, so you like you just get the trout tickler and then you move into a private pirate and you know, and all this stuff. That'd be great. I'd love that.
Because I'm writing this book about descending, an abseiling book. And it's exactly the same thing. It's like not names for things.
Yeah.
We need to have a name for it. I got this thing called, I think it's called a Murphy sling, which is just like a pre-built sling for when you're setting up abseils, when you're separate from the abseil. And I just thought, like, basically, when all else fails, this has to work. So I just called it like a Murphy sling. And I thought it'd be quite funny if people started saying, like, oh, yeah, I need to set up a Murphy sling up. And I tried to get away from using
the... Why did you call it a Murphy sling?
I think it was just like, so it became like a thing, rather than just a sling, because, you know, like, is it the word protocol? Yeah, do you know this thing, like, there's all these protocols in the book. So one of them is like the last pair, you know, there's always a backup for the first person.
Mm.
So the first person down is protected and the last person takes up the backup, and it's called like LEPAR or something protocol. So I tried to create all these things when I started climbing, no one ever used a prussic loop as a backup. And slowly it's got like...
Wrap it around your leg.
Yeah, or some shit like that. Or nothing at all. If I mean knots in the end of it. And the rope. And that's probably how people used to get killed. Mm. And it's amazing how many people you meet now. Like, it was at Krakow. Like, Thomas Huber and like loads of people. And they're like asking about climbing accidents. And all of them were like abseiling off the end of the rope.
Mm.
And somehow not dying. But then other people who die. There's one person where his girlfriend ended up like... paraplegic, abseiled off the rope, and then she committed suicide. It's like, Christ almighty, like, why did it take us so long just to tie knots in the rope or do a list of simple kind of stuff? But I was trying to get away from using the word prussic loop, because when you're teaching someone, it's like, well, tie this, but it's not actually a prussic knot. It's like an auto block, which is a kind of prussic knot, but it's not a prussic knot. And also, it's not a loop, it's actually like a length of cord, it's like a strand of cord. And it creates all this like confusion when you're trying to teach somebody. Because we know, like, you need to use a daisy chain, but it's not actually a daisy chain, it's actually an adjustable sling, which is more like a lanyard and blah, blah, blah. And so just trying to get down to a really basic way of describing everything. Mm. So I think it's called like a hitch cord or something, but then you just find that it's just in the language, it's so strong. Like, some people call it like a third hand or a backup something that's really ingrained in how you think, how we do things without ever thinking about, so, you know, like a classic etrier, like a ADA, we call it. You know, it's the shape it is because it's how we used to tie it out of tape. You know, because and then someone started sewing them. But it doesn't need to look like that. It's just that's how it was when we started knots in it. But no one really thought about it. So like a ladder style is like the best way to do it. But you know, for like 20, 30 years we had ones which were just just that shape because that's how you would saw them.
How were they?
They were like offset steps.
Oh yeah, offset steps. That's like what I've got.
Yeah, because that's just because that's how you tie it with a piece of tape.
Yeah, right.
But really, want like a ladder one's much easier. You can step in it much easier.
Yeah, yeah. The problem with those ladder ones is they crush it. Well, it depends if they have
the stiff bar
at the top. But if they're proper.
So going back to the language of something. Like, yeah, so when you say, like, tickling trout...
the trout tickler.
Like it's, like
and
it's,
the light bulb it's, changer.
But it's like so perfect.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Because trying to teach someone how to do something, especially when you're not there you're constantly checking yourself. Like I was saying right this morning about if you have to descend on a piece of, like, electron ladder, because it covers everything about how to descend. So sometimes you go to places and there's like literally a piece of old electron ladder, or there's a bit of chain, but literally like bike chain, or there's bit of hose pipe. There's all this, you know, the more you climb around the world, the more you experience all this shit that's just like fixed on the routes. And
have you found bike chains?
Yeah. Like an island, you'll see
bike chains. I haven't found any bike chains.
You're trying to cover yourself, like saying, like fix ropes generally don't snap when you're abseiling on them. They're generally going to snap when you're dewmaring on them. And also when you're abseiling on them, you can see where the damage is. But when you're going up, you can't see where the damage is. So they're more like, anyway. But then you're trying to cover yourself by saying, but sometimes they do snap, you know. And it's such a complicated, just the idea of a fixed rope, you know, coming down east ledges of El Cap. You know, it's like really super complicated, but it's just a bit of rope hanging down.
Yeah.
But then, you know, people just abseil off the end of the rope because the rope was broken or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So you can see why, so crack climbing, it's just a crack and you climb off it. But yeah, like how many words is it?
I think it's maybe 80,000.
Yeah.
85,000.
And it's like shitloads of illustrations.
It's got lots of illustrations. I didn't actually do the illustrations. Somebody else did them. But
you dodged a bullet there.
I'm not very well. It's lots of like hands and feet and body parts, and I'm not very good at drawing that sort of stuff. So
did it go out to many people to read?
To read it before it went out. No. No, it was just me. So I basically wrote all the, I just literally sat down and wrote all the text, and I didn't actually refer to any other books or any other articles or anybody else's ideas that were out there.
Yeah.
It was all just the knowledge.
What you know.
Yeah, the knowledge that I've learned from going crack climbing.
Yeah.
And then just like condensed into that book. And then it was John, the editor of Vertebrate, who edited it all.
So he was like their everyman, I guess. Like when he was reading it, he was, does this make sense to me?
Yeah. And he's a climber, and he was the main editor. And then there were two other people who read it.
Interesting.
But I didn't show anybody. My work before.
Yeah. Are you embarrassed at all about writing a book, or does it feel like just suddenly just come out with this book? Was it a really great creative process, or was it, what made you start doing it?
I initially started doing it because, I was getting loads of questions after doing these like crack workshops.
Yeah.
I was getting loads of questions, and then I was getting loads of questions through sort of like Instagram.
Here by the book.
And it's like you can only answer so many, and you can only answer like
so
in depth. And I was just like, I have all this information in my head, and I feel like I know a lot more than what is already out there as well in terms of like crack climbing content. I was just like, I'm going to like put it all in a book. Just like everything I know.
Do you get a lot of questions about silent partners as well?
I do get quite a few questions about rope soloing actually as well. I get a lot of questions about rope soloing. But to be honest, I don't really feel like I know that much. I have done a whole bunch of rope soloing, but to be honest, I don't really feel like I know that much about,
that. It's like one of those things where you're almost, like I was on that, there was like a Facebook group, like rope soloing group. I had to leave it because people were just so dangerous.
Right.
You know, I think you have to go through the process of learning
to
understand what you don't know, really.
Yeah. I only really, in rope sawing, I only really feel like I know how to do sort of like one system.
Yeah.
Just like the system that I've used.
Yeah.
To like free climb and rope solo, and that's it.
Yeah.
But I don't really feel like I know.
And again, it's
I mean, I would be able to do it. You know, if I was like going and climbing, like aiding a big wall.
Yeah.
And soloing it and hauling my bag and all that sort of stuff, then I would know, like I know how to do it.
Yeah, but yeah.
It's not like I have, I don't really feel like I have a great knowledge in it, but people still always ask me loads of questions.
Yeah. I guess you're...
people just want an answer though, don't they? It doesn't really matter what it is.
Yeah, yeah. Pete said this. Pete, just hold on with your hand if you fall off. But even that, like rope soloing, again, there's like, people send you questions and what they mean is like top roping, soloing. You know,
right.
Or, you know, like, they don't really fundamentally understand what you're even talking about.
It's sort of like on a fixed line.
Yeah, what do you call that?
Plugging or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Was
it? Yeah. Again, there's like millions of names. Like even there's that knot you use, but it's probably got a different name. You have words in your head, but you don't know what they sound like. There's a, you know, like a macrae thingy knot. You know, not where you put a bite around something, like a tree, and you used to call it a slippery hitch. And then when you pull on one strand, the knot comes apart and you can pull it down. There's about like five names for this knot. It's like French have a different name for it. But it's, you know, like you might have someone on a tree but you don't leave a sling. You just put a bite around and then you tie the knot.
Yeah, right. I don't know that.
You just pull them on one strand and it all comes apart.
Oh, like, really?
One strand's kind of good.
Right. No, and, I don't know that one.
Yeah, but like just coming up with like one name. Maybe I should make a name up for this.
Make a name up for it. Maybe I should make a name up for it now.
Knob end's not. One of the knob end goes first. Have you got any Whittaker moves? Is it like a Whittaker?
No. They're all to do with either food or animals. Yeah, like the wide pony or the donut jam or like child tickler all that kind of stuff.
Child tickler, what does that look like?
Child tickler is basically it can kind of cover quite a few different jams, but it's basically where you're jamming one body part against another body part, but it's usually like a sort of hand or a fist against a leg or like a finger. I remember doing once on a route and I had this hold in like a sort of a Gaston style.
Yeah.
And then the only way to make it work was to actually finger jam in the slot against my own finger jam.
Right.
So,
yeah,
you know, like your finger, to make the finger jam, to make the hold work, you're actually using like a double finger jam, but the finger jams were finger jamming against each other.
Oh, right.
Yeah. We call that like a sardine tickler. It's slightly smaller.
These are t-shirts. With
these names on. Yeah.
And do you ever like meet some of those really old, you know, when you're like the really old time crack climbers, like in Yosemite or in like Moab or wherever? Do you ever talk to them and do they have a different, what's their relationship to crack climbing compared to you? Do you ever talk to those old guys?
I haven't actually met that many of... I've met a few people, but I interviewed quite a lot of people for the book.
Oh, right.
So I spoke to some folks on email.
Yeah.
It was quite interesting. Yeah, it was quite interesting speaking to some of them and some of the like stories that they came back with.
Yeah.
I like the one that Peter Croft wrote.
Yeah.
Because he's a bit of a legend.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's just quite funny because I ask everybody to like... tell an interesting or memorable story.
Yeah.
And he's talking about just going out and how he solos, you know, just like nonchalantly soloing this 512A finger crack or something. And then he gets this like bat in the crack and it's like shouting at him basically.
Yeah.
And the only way he can get away from it is like carry on climbing. But then this bat like carries on and follows him up and then he gets to the top, but he can't top out on the route. And the only way to get down is to down climb this like 12A route. And he just goes into like how he's like, oh, a little bit nervous, not about the 512A down climb of this finger crack, but about going past this bat again and whether it's going to like follow him back down. So yeah, it's, I don't know. Yeah. It's quite funny speaking to these guys.
You've never been like one of these like free soloing people, have you?
I'm not really into like Yeah, hard.
A bit like Tommy Caldwell. They both like, sort of unique, really. You never seem to have gone down that path.
Yeah, not. I mean, I have done free soloing, and I've done a lot of free soloing on the gritstone around here.
Yeah, you've probably done quite a lot of routes where you were basically free soloing anyway, I guess.
Yeah, and like that sort of, that sort of thing. You just got a rope attached to you.
Yeah,
and it's more for mental stability. And I have done like some like free solo and some bigger things as well, but only like in very moderation and on easy ground. I never really feel like I want to try and push a standard.
Yeah.
A standard of free song. I don't enjoy it.
Does that come from being a very like level-headed person? Because you know, I always think about, so I think you're kind of similar to like Tommy Caldwell in that I always think you've both as very stable people, where other people I could mention are probably less stable, and that manifests itself in how they climb and their how people engage with them.
Yeah,
like I know
like some people, like some free soloists, they sort of like enjoy the feeling of climbing hard and free soloing hard.
Yeah,
but I just fucking hate that.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels awful.
Yeah.
Like, I don't mind it if it's, like, completely within your ability.
Yeah.
And it's, like, me free-soloing something is, like, you know, your everyday person walking up the stairs or something. Because you feel in control, you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't have any problems with it. But as soon as you start to, like, push it where the consequence is, like, certain 50-50. Death. Well, no, certain death if you, like, fall. It's not just, like, on the gritstone crags where...
Yeah.
Because I've pushed it quite hard on the gritstone crags, but... It's not quite the same as like pushing it hard on bigger multi-pitch routes or anything. I just don't like the feeling.
Yeah.
At all.
There's like an aspect of performance as well when people are soloing. Like they like people to see them doing it. Like Peter Croft is unusual. Like he probably solo shit no one ever knows he's done.
Yeah, that's probably.
Where other people, it's like, I remember like, was it last 2 years ago? Finally got around to doing Snake Dyke.
Yeah.
And you're on Snake Dyke and it was like, I think the trick to Snake Dyke is turning up late.
Yeah.
Because everybody else is like going up there. But there's like literally a party on every B-lay going up. And some guy like came past like soloing up and he just looked so sketchy. And like, why would you do it when there's so many people up there who are dropping things, everything else. Yeah. And then there's someone else who... The guy was soloing with his girlfriend, and there's that. You must have done Snake Dyke.
I've not done it.
All right, but it's like super. Like you literally would have to throw yourself off.
Yeah.
It's like a Via Ferrata without any Via Ferrata thing. It's just like walking up it. But there's like one bit where, you know, if you're doing like a lot of slab climbing. You know when you do that one move on the slab and you're just like, oh, I'm not going to fall off. You have to tell yourself.
Yeah.
I just have to stand up, and then there's going to be a hold. So you've got to do this move, and then you realise actually a bolt there. Because you're so used to climbing in Tuolumne where there's no bolt. Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh, actually, there's a bolt. That's easy. You just clip it and you just stand up. But that's the only bit. If you're soloing it, you're kind of like... My foot's not going to slip.
Mm.
And I just saw this woman like halfway on this move.
What, soloing?
Yeah, soloing. Yeah. With the boyfriend was above her, like... taking a also selfie. Soloing. Yeah, soloing, yeah.
Oh, they're both?
Yeah, and you're just like, fuck yeah, what are you doing? Like, that kind of... The ego thing of like, I think it's one of these things, it's kind of good to do it when no one's there. Like, I always thought that was interesting about Uli Steck, how he would go and solo something without anyone knowing, and then he would go back, and then he would like re-climb bits of it for camera or photographs. But he always had that out where he can just say, like, I'm not going to do it, I'm just going to do something else. But I think that act of like performance is kind of what is, you know, like even the El Cap thing, like it's kind of with you know soloing El Cap, there is that extra little bit of pressure when you've got Jimmy Chin and everyone else fucking hanging up there, you know, yeah, you can just say I'm not going to do it, but there is that like
I guess so. Yeah,
you ever that sort of Evel Knievel, like he went to Wembley Stadium and they had all these buses. You know, you can jump over all these London buses.
Oh, yeah.
And they had the ramp because it came all the way down from the side of the stadium, down and then up over these buses. And when he came out, he looked down. And I don't think he'd ever seen it. And he just looked down and he said, I can't do it. It's too far. And everyone was there, you know, like, evil, evil. And like, what are you going to do? He said, I'll just have to try.
Yeah.
And he went down. I think he crashed. But like, just right. that, it's like, well, everyone's here. I'm just going to have to try.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'll just strap myself. I think when he went on his rocket car across the Grand Canyon, I think he was like, you know, 100% sure he was going to die.
Mm.
But he just did it because, you know, the TV cameras were there. And
yeah.
But yeah.
I think there probably are quite a lot of solo climbers who... I mean, they just go out and just go soloing anyway, don't they?
Yeah.
It's not like there are people around. I think it's quite a normal thing to do.
Just to go have a circuit. Yeah, just to do them all.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm always kind of wary when there's people around. I think you have that, because it's always kind of hardcore to solo. You know, you see there's really popular routes on El Cap on you know, like in Yosemite, and there's like people like, oh, excuse me, can I just go past you and whatever. It always seems like daft really to me, but maybe I'm getting old.
Yeah.
Like on Stanage, it's great when you're on the grit, just like soloing all these routes.
Yeah.
You know, and it's...
It is nicer when you're just by yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know, especially like... I know sometimes like I'll just go out one evening on the grit and just, you know, just do like a nice circuit of very easy climbs and ones that I know and, you know, just nip around them. But you feel like, sometimes you just feel like a bit of a douchebag. You know, it's like, oh, all I want to do is just go out and solo these routes, but it's really busy at the popular end.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm, you know, I've done these routes loads of times, but then you sort of feel like,
oh, God, that's Pete Whitaker over there.
No, but then you sort of feel like, oh, some of these routes are sort of like big lifetime goals for people.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just sort of feel like, oh, I feel like a bit of a douche.
Yeah.
But all I want to do is just come out and do my circuit and then go home.
You're doing like Flying Butchers Direct with like a pot on your leg or something.
Yeah, like Jerry. But yeah, you just sometimes feel like, oh, I wish there wasn't anybody else there.
I think the second podcast I did was about staying alive. And I was talking about how we can like lead other people astray, like young climbers, because they see that, oh, well, I was on Stanage and Pete was soloing, you know, something, and like, oh, you know, that's what I need to be like. Yeah. But they don't see the full picture of like who you are and what you've done, and you've done the route like a million times. You've done it 20 times on a rope or whatever. And I think
people are strange.
I think I always think that. Yeah, so again, I guess it's back to like, so you and Tommy Caldwell are like, in my mind, are really good ambassadors for climbing. I think you're very good ambassadors just as people as well, but because I just think you're very solid. I just think you've got a very good you seem to have a very good foundation. And Tommy's the same, isn't it? Basically, like
he
learned all the, you know, the thing about his dad said never go ice climbing, never solo or something, and it sort of stuck in his head, and that's why he doesn't do it.
Yeah,
you know, and I think it is having that foundation. Again, it's this thing about knowing the. You know the rules, and you know when you're breaking them.
Yeah.
But some people don't know the rules. Yeah, they don't maybe, know they're breaking them.
Yeah. I probably had quite a good... I did have a good sort of foundation with going out climbing with my parents and stuff. And they're very they like to be safe.
Yeah.
You know, but I feel like some of the stuff we did when I was younger, you know, like going out and doing some of these things. I mean, there was some risk to it,
yeah.
You know, for them taking me and my sister wherever we went and doing these things. You know, there is some certain amount of risk to doing it. But I always feel like the risk was managed in a safe way.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably like one of the things that I've learned
from
being younger and with my family. Like,
you know where the line is in the way.
I like to think I do.
Yeah.
I like to hope so, but I mean, for sure, I've definitely done like dangerous things.
Yeah.
Like definitely really dangerous things, but I like to feel like I've managed the risk so that they become less dangerous.
Yeah. You
know? But yeah. Also, yeah. So there is.
Yeah.
There is that kind of lesser risk.
Risk is a really weird. It's weird that we have this idea of a line. Like I'm always wary of creating these like models in our head that are like a fixed idea. Like, you know, people say like, oh, how are you feeling? Like, oh, I'm like, oh, I feel like 80% good or something. Like really, a human being is like an ink. You know, when you pour ink onto water, it's just oil onto water. It's this constantly changing thing. Mm. It's what is you define yourself. I define danger as a line is kind of dangerous because that line is like 10 miles wide or something, and you're like a millimeter like in the middle of it or something. But I think when you're going around like in Sheffield today, you see like people cycling with their kids on the back in a little trailer. Yeah. But for me, that's more dangerous than like taking your daughter a Pell cap or whatever.
Yeah.
The way they see the risk is maybe different. So
yeah, I think everybody sees it differently, don't they?
So often climbers can be super risk averse. People who think, oh, this person does dangerous stuff, therefore they take lots of risks. Often it's the opposite way around.
Yeah, well, I actually just wrote an article about danger and risk.
Oh, right. Yeah, who for?
It was for Rock and Ice.
Yeah. Another plug. I was getting them all in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a big difference between, a dangerous climber and a risky climber.
Yeah.
Because you can have a dangerous climber who's not taking much risk.
Yeah.
But you can have a risky climber who is very dangerous.
Yeah.
you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can have like a top climber who's doing really dangerous things, but doing them safely.
Yeah.
And what is perceived as being really, really hard, and what people might see as actually being very risky.
Yeah.
But they're not actually doing it in a very risky way.
Yeah.
Whereas you could actually go to somewhere like Stanage on the weekend and then see people taking much higher risk.
Yeah. Unaware of it.
Maybe. Yeah, but sort of like unaware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I won't mention any names. I know. I remember talking to like someone who people think was a very dangerous climber, talking about climbing with another climber who people think was really dangerous.
Yeah.
Who subsequently died, and he said he didn't want to climb with him because he was too dangerous.
Right.
And he took too many risks, like he would take out gear unnecessarily and things like that. And I thought that was really interesting how, someone can be very aware of what they're doing, and the. Like even the Hoover brothers, I met like Thomas Hoover last week, and he was saying about when they were like speed climbing Zodiac and stuff, they just have like one draw with a rope locks with a club hitched into it, just a one open screw gear, and that's all there was between the two of them.
Yeah.
And they just had this like total confidence. And I think when they were when they brought the record on the nose, there was like one wire on the Great Roof. That was the only thing they had. So Thomas was like jumarring up on this wire, fixed wire. And then Alex was just like kind of free soloing up with this huge loop of rope. But what you don't realize is that they'd gone up there and like hammered this wiring with a hammer.
Yeah.
And they were 100% sure that wire was good.
Yeah.
And they knew that when Thomas was hanging on this Petzl carabiner, well, it wasn't a screw gear because it was weighted. It wasn't going to come undone. And again, it's like once you go into the real nitty gritty of it, it looks really dangerous, but
you can do quite incredible things when you're psyched.
Yeah.
But when you actually have like something in mind and a project and you're psyched, then I think I felt like I noticed that this year when I was out in Yosemite, because last year I'd climbed both Half Dome and El Cap in the same day.
Yeah.
A solo day, both in the same day. And I went out this year with some solo projects and objectives, and I started doing like a little bit of practice and stuff. And I was just like, holy crap, like some of the stuff I did last year, like I must have been really psyched to have done that. And then I was just like, my God, I'm not feeling up to that. Anymore.
Is that maturity?
I don't know.
Are you in love or something?
Yeah. and then I just I sort of like totally sacked those projects off.
Yeah.
And just called it a day with that.
But
at the time I didn't notice it because I was so psyched and it.
It's amazing how you can. I wonder if it's like if you were fighting like. So if like a polar bear came in this room now and all you had was that knife, knife, you grabbed the knife.
Yeah.
Either you or the polar bear.
Yeah.
Like if someone said to you, You know, what are you going to do? You're either going to die or fight to the death, and you're probably going to lose anyway.
Do I have this oat milk as well?
Yeah, well, a knife and an oat milk. Yeah.
But like, as an abstract thought, you're like, but when it's really happening, you know, it's amazing when you're actually in the middle of something that you look back. I remember I've had times where I've just walked in the middle of the night and I thought back the things I've done as a climbing. It just terrified me to think about, like, what was I even thinking? Like, why am I going up? Like, trying to solo the Eiger or whatever. And you look back and, like, what the fuck was I thinking? Like, it doesn't make any sense. But in the moment, you know. I tried to solo the Harlan on the Eiger. I remember just being stuck on this one place for about 4 days, all this just really bad weather. And then I had to, like, fix rope, and I started jugging up the next day, and all this snow, it landed on my head like an avalanche of snow. And you just look back and you're like, what was the anchor and everything? And you're like, you're just in this space where it becomes this normalization of doing something. They didn't die, so probably you were safer than you thought, but maybe once you're back, when you're comfortable. So when you soloed the two walls in a day, and also the when you soloed, which one of the most amazing things, you're soloing Salathe in a day, like free soloing it, rope soloing. Sure, yeah. But unfortunately, they got, you know, then Alex did his thing. But what you did was just as impressive, really, because you had to do it three times. Yeah. And like, what, where were you, like, in a, like, a mental state at that time? Like, were you happy, and were your relationships all right in your life and everything else? Or turmoil or anything? Yeah.
No, I don't think so. No. When was that? It was 2016 and 2018. It was either side.
You had no one to live for. Yeah.
It was all good. I don't think that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Really. Sort of.
It didn't surprise me. Like, I'm always interested in climbers' relationships, and whenever I talk to you about your relationships, they always have this really, like, practical, no nonsense sort of view of it. You know, you never seem to be, I know my wife, like, she had like a long term relationship, and when it broke up, she had like one day where she was like totally devastated, and then she seemed to just get on with the rest of her life.
Yeah.
Where other people spend the rest of their life getting over this, like, 1 week relationship. So it's, yes, but that often seems to play a big part in, you know, some people, like, they break up with someone, and then 10 years later, they're still soloing and doing crazy shit because of this weird, you know, I guess it's a relationship with themselves, isn't it? It's never about that thing. It's about themselves.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. I never really feel like any of...
No, you don't want to kill yourself.
I don't really feel like any of my relationships have, like, affected the climbs that I've done, or made me do the climbs that I've done.
Yeah.
Like, even if I was in them or wasn't in them, I would have still gone and done the climbs that I did.
Like, you're never sort of making a statement, are you? I think it's just about, it's always about you. I think it's always about you and your selfish, you know.
Yeah,
But you're just doing what, you're almost like playing. It's like I'm playing out. I'm going out. I want to do this. You've not got this, like, strategic goal of, like, in a way.
I mean,
you have a personal goal.
Yeah, no, I definitely have goals, but...
But you know, like, what will get me on the front cover of Rock and Ice?
No, it's more about, like, what's going to challenge me, you know, because, like, I guess the whole thing with the crack climbing, when I first started out with that, I guess I was maybe like 17 or 18.
Yeah.
And I guess it was really fun because I didn't know much about it. And it was just challenging because I didn't know much about it. And then the sort of, like, learning curve is really quick.
Yeah.
So then you learn really quickly, and then, like, it's just fun, and you see that learning curve, and then you get better at it, and then you want to carry on doing it more. But then you get to a certain point and you're like, or for me, it's sort of like, oh, well, I feel like I've kind of done that now. I still really love crack climbing, but I feel like I've done a lot of it. And then I started, like, you know, then, like, started looking at big walls, and then I wanted to go big walling, and then you sort of do a few big walls and you're like, it was challenging, but then I could just go out and do the same thing again and try and freeze some harder routes on El Cap. But I don't know, it's kind of the same as what I've just done. And sort of like, where's the challenge in that? And then that's where I got onto like rope soloing. So I was like, oh, what can I do? Yeah. It's like, oh, well, maybe I'll go rope soloing.
Yeah.
And then you sort of get onto that. And then again, you see that like quick learning curve. And then you do it. And then you sort of...
You've got attention deficit syndrome, I think.
and then you've done it. And then it's sort of like, and then you move on to the next thing. And I guess the last couple of years, I've been doing some more sort of like ice climbing and winter climbing. And again, like I started out just completely knowing absolutely bugger all.
Yeah.
I remember the first ice climb I did, I took one step up and ripped a massive hole in my trousers. And I've done like a little bit over the last few years. And again, you just see like the learning curve.
Do you like being a novice, do you think?
Yeah, probably, yeah. Maybe that's it.
Yeah.
But it's... it's good to be shit at something, but then I also like being good at something.
Yeah.
So I like to feel good at doing something, and I like to do that thing to the best of my ability.
Yeah.
But then when I feel I've got to the best of my ability, then I guess that's when I'm sort of like always looking for new things. Sort of like with the rope soloing thing. I did 3 years of rope soloing in different sort of challenges in Yosemite.
Yeah.
And then I went out with a goal this time in Yosemite, and I just didn't really have the love to do it anymore.
I remember thinking that. I remember going to do a route on the Dwats, like in the Alps. And it was like, I think we set off, you know, like 2 a.m, and it was like, oh, the spindrift coming down. And we sat in this like bothy bag at the bottom until it got light, so you weren't going to be able to do it. I remember just sitting there, it was fucking freezing, just thinking like, there was nothing to learn doing this anymore. Like, I've done this already. Like, I'm not going to learn anything.
Yeah.
And is that, I think people do just go through the motions. Mm. Maybe they go through the motions in everything, like in the relationships. Like, they have this, like, failing marriage, failing relationship, failing, they hate their job, they hate all these things. But they just kind of keep going on with it because that's what they do. They're an expert at having a shit life. You know, that's the one thing they can be good at. But climbing is the same. Like, these people who just say like, oh, I'm going to actually go into sailing. I gave up mountaineering. I got into sea kayaking or sailing or I got into like environmentalism or something. I always think that shows like kind of maturity that you could just move on and not, you know, you're not like an 80-year-old guy who's like, you know, staggering, staggering up a mountain or something.
To the sport, Craig.
Yeah. I mean, what were you like at school? Were you academic or?
I wasn't like the cleverest person, but I was. But I tried really hard, actually.
Yeah.
So I did pretty well.
Were you like dyslexic or anything? Did you have any of these?
No. I'd say I was just. I was good in some subjects, more the sort of like arty, designy, sporty subjects.
Yeah.
And then I was just like middle of the road, or like a bit above average in the sort of academic subjects.
Yeah.
But I would say it was more through actually like trying hard.
Yeah.
And putting the work in. I did try hard at school.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't sack it off at all. Yeah. Like I tried hard and. Like,
is that through your parents? Was your mum a teacher?
She used to be a long time ago.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Before instilled something in you. remember at like Ella, my daughter, she was one of these people where people would always say, oh, you're not very artistic. Your brother's really artistic, or your dad's artistic, but you're not really art. You're like the brainy one, you know, you're good at maths and all kind of stuff. And then when she went, it was like, you know, like halfway through like senior school, she just said, I'm going to start doing art.
Yeah.
And she ended up getting like an A A-levels in art. And she said, oh, it was easy. I just tried really hard.
Yeah.
And she just, and I think maybe you do meet people. This is probably one way why you're good at what you do, is they can just look at something and they can dismantle it down.
Yeah.
And work out all its component parts and what makes something good, what makes something bad, and then they just put it back together again, and they can just do it to like a certain level.
Yeah.
You know, where it looks like they're really good at it. Like everything's in the right place.
Mm.
Like that's what I did with writing. Like I literally used to look at how the paragraphs were set on the page and just look at the blocks of text and think, oh, well, that's what a paragraph looks like.
Yeah.
How big are they? And how, do you know what I mean? Like literally just trying to break it down
to the
most fundamental components and then trying to build it all back up again in your head.
Yeah. I guess I quite like sort of,
Problem solving.
Yeah, problem solving and sort of like analysing
analysis.
What was good and what was bad. You know if you're like you rope solo route or something. And like I remember the first time I rope solo route, it was a total disaster. Like absolute disaster. But you just I guess like some people at that point would just go, oh, what is this? And give up. Shit. But I think it's I quite like it, and you sort of like learn from what you've done.
Yeah,
and then
you do it a bit better.
You do it a little bit better next time.
Yeah.
And then it's still never perfect. Like I always think, I was telling somebody recently when like with soloing, rope soloing, I think like for the last 3 years in Yosemite, I think I've done some of the, probably made some of the worst mistakes and done some of the most stupid things. Yeah. But I've also done some of the most impressive things as well in my climbing, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's quite funny, like nobody can ever see those. Nobody can ever see the carnage.
That's
but,
a good
but
thing.
But nobody can ever see the brilliance either.
Yeah.
It's just
when I tried to solo the troll wall, I seem to remember you could abseil on a silent partner.
Yeah.
And I remember setting it up and then starting abseil down, and it was just wasn't working, and I was like sort of going down like hardly under control. And then I had these like Russian Ada things on, which goes around your leg. And one of them like got caught on a piece of gear and ended up like hanging by my leg, like upside down. And he's like, oh my God, I'm going to fucking die. And how embarrassing. Like, what the hell was he doing up there? And I had it when last time I was in Yosemite, I had like the perfect soloing moment for a soloist, in that I was, you know, the Japanese guy who's free climbed the nose.
Yes.
You
know, I met him. I met him this time. Yeah.
So we had a weird. Yeah. I had a weird thing in that I was on another wall next to the nose on tribal right, and he was coming up, and I was like, oh hi, and he's like, oh are you Andy? And I'm like, oh yeah. He said, oh, I read your book. We were having this like conversation, and he's like, you know, free climb soloing up. I was like looking at how he was doing it and everything else. It was like, do you want to, you know, yeah, I've got a bit of a question for you. But anyway, he was practicing soloing like the free blast or something.
Yeah.
So I was we were coming down off the wall, and I could see him up there, and he had his rope like in a rope bag, and he was like on the second picture. He had like a really super long rope, like 100 meter rope or something. He was soloing along, and as the end of the rope came out of the rope bag, he just like flicked into a crack and just jammed in his crack, and he was there like, and I was like, hang on a minute. And as he went over there, I just like pulled it out. And he was like, oh, thank you. He was like the patron saint of soloists. Like, oh, thank you very much.
Oh, man.
But I guess that's the Murphy's Law when you're soloing, that everything will always, like the rope is feeding the wrong way, you know, through a piece of gear or, you know. I think I once did it where I actually had the rope the wrong way around. So if I'd fallen, the rope would have just gone, the end I thought was attached to the anchor. Wasn't attached to anything. It was the wrong end. So I'd fallen. The rope would have just whizzed all the way. Oh no, that was it. I put all the gear was on the rope coming out of the rope bag.
Just falling back to the belay.
I would have taken like a factor two onto the belay. God. Oh God. There's those things that you wake up and like, oh God, like oh. But I think when you're writing, that's what you're always trying to avoid. Like there's part of me that thinks it's like big wall. This big wall book I wrote. It's like three. Did I your copy of it?
Yeah.
So it's like someone with ADHD has like written this like some kind of something wrong with him. But it's so detailed, and part of me thinks that maybe that's a mistake, because in learning all that stuff in that book, that's how you get good at it, or you don't do something bad as you're climbing.
Mm.
If someone just gives you all on the plate, it's kind of a little bit risky. But maybe
a lot of people have said like, oh, how did you write this book, or how did you learn all the stuff in this book? I'm just like, oh, I don't know, I just went climbing. tried it, see what worked and see what didn't work. Yeah.
And I guess you've been climbing long enough that there wasn't that much. It wasn't like you just go on YouTube when you were first, when you were like 15, 16.
Yeah.
There wasn't like YouTube to go on there and see like Pete Whittaker showing you how to tape up, whatever.
No.
There was still that process of reading books and learning and asking people. Which nowadays, so that's one of my things, is people know more than they've ever known before, but they understand less than they've ever understood.
Yeah, maybe.
There's just like so much information out there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very hard to to, you know, if you had a Google ranking, so if you know, if you had a Google ranking for knots, you know, you'd have like figure of eight would be like, you know, a top ranking, then it would go all the way down. But people don't really know that this knot, this weird, you know, alpine butterfly is actually, you know, fifth in the ranking, and then everything looks like it's kind of equal. If you're tying like climbing knots, you'll see some weird Italian way of tying a double bowline or something, and you'll think that's just as equal, you know. So it's, yeah, so it's trying to direct people towards the vanilla meat and two veg, you know, white sliced bread stuff. And I guess that's what what we had. We're looking that when we started climbing, we had parents who like,
yeah,
this is how you slice us. This is how you put some white bread. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
What about, have you got any lactose intolerant? I'll let you go in a second. Funny, I'm looking at your milk. I might have told this story already on one of my other podcasts, but we were climbing in Kenya, and Vanessa is like high maintenance. You met Vanessa, high maintenance Irish woman. You know, she likes to have like a toilet and, you know, stuff like that. You know,
she likes to have a toilet
and she, floss. We were like helping these African, this tribe of Africans, like to get into rock climbing, and she's always like, oh, I'm lactose intolerant, I won't drink milk and all that kind of stuff. And I went off climbing with these guys, and she went up this big mountain with all these elephants on it. Mountain elephants actually live on, you know, like a goat.
Mm.
They're actually elephants that live like on the side of a mountain. It's like really crazy. So she went up there, and the guy was like walking along, and the guy was like, so he had like a guide, like an AK-47, and the guide was like, are you hungry? And he's like, oh yeah, I'm hungry. So he's gonna have like a sandwich or something. And these guys, they're like super vain. Like they have like a little mirror. All they have is like a blanket. It was a really nice blanket. And then they have like a belt. They have like a mirror, a little cup, and a mobile phone. And the guy's like, oh, and he just grabs his cow and he just slices a little hole in the cow, squeezes out some blood, and then like squeezes some milk out, and then this gives her like some this blood tea. She like drinks it. I'm like, bloody typical, you know. Like you're always like, oh no, I don't have any milk. And it's like, so you know, I don't mind telling that story, but I think I'm lactose something. I'm missing some proper tea, so I might have to.
Oh, you are now.
Yeah,
yeah. So you're gonna have to
feel a bit edgy. Yeah, you know, like
yeah, from the oats.
Yeah. But anyway, it's been good. Good to talking to you. Good to nice say you're talking to you all day. Yeah. Or you need to go and do some pull-ups or something or some...
Am I going to do some pull-ups? Yeah. Am I going to do some pull-ups later?
Actually, but yeah. I just asked before you go, like, what are you climbing... What was your hardest sort of sport climbing at the moment grade have you climbed?
I have climbed 8C+.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you need to just pull your finger out of it.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Like, do you think could you be climbing as hard as you can climb, you think, if you put your mind to that? Sport climbing?
I guess if I fully focused on sport climbing, then I believe I could climb harder than that. But I've never really... I've never tried anything harder than that grade.
Yeah.
And I've never really focused...
Is that easy now, 80 plus? Is that just
it's easy now in world standards, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like walking or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's just a warm-up for your sport climbing folk, isn't it? Yeah, I guess I've never really put more than a couple of months of effort into sport climbing at sort of periods of time. So
do you think you ever will? It's not rocky,
no, I do like sport climbing, but not at the moment. Yeah. I sort of have other things which I'd like to do. But and maybe
what's your ambition? What's your future? What's your next thing? What fills your mind?
What fills my mind?
Yeah, what do you think about when you're making holds?
Oh, what do I think about when I'm making holes?
Yeah. Have you got like a plan you're working on?
What in terms of climbing plan? I have a few trips. I don't have much in the spring actually, but in the autumn I have some trips. One to sort of like greater ranges.
Yeah.
Sunday. Yeah.
Where are you going?
To Nepal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is the plan of action.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's that with?
With my friends Matt and John.
Yeah.
Yeah. You must know Matt and John Helica.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And John Bracey, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So with those guys.
Yeah. Two mountain guides will probably charge you a fortune.
So, so that
have they got some secret objective that's got a big crack in it or something?
Well, the thing that we're going to do is it's got a mixture between sort of like mixed climbing and rock climbing.
Yeah.
So I think it will work quite well to our skills, as long as I like can actually breathe.
Yeah.
that's my main concern.
I give you my permission to go. You know, young climber. You'll be safe for those guys anyway.
I think that's my main sort of thought about that. I'm not too worried about sort of like the climbing aspect.
Yeah.
Because I feel like, I've seen those guys climbing that, like, I can send those guys up the sort of mixed pitches.
Yeah.
And that's great. And I can get on the Jumars and follow them.
Yeah.
And then they can send me up the rock pitches. And yeah, that's fine. And I feel very confident with that.
Yeah.
But I think I've never gone to any kind of height before.
Yeah.
So that could be quite interesting.
Yeah.
Could be just like totally puking, and
it's like doing press ups with a plastic bag on your head.
Yeah, like have you been to any altitude or
only Denali, which is like six.
Yeah, so that's quite high.
Yeah.
6.5.
But then like Vanessa had never been to high altitude and she was completely fine.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is about you misidentifying other things as altitude sickness.
Mm.
Like the fact that you don't sleep, the fact that you're not eating enough, the fact that you're getting carbon monoxide poisoning from your stove—all all these things that people like just lump them all into being high altitude sickness. You know, people like eat, you know, they just make loads of mistakes.
Mm.
You know, they don't sleep because they want to have a piss all night long,
because
they haven't got a piss bottle, or the piss bottle's too small, or it's all these little tiny details. And I guess with John and Matt, it's one of these things that just like do exactly what they do all the time, you know.
And
just see, oh, it's all those little things, isn't it, that people do?
Yeah.
I've noticed
from climbing with Matt over these last few years, he's really good and he's very knowledgeable about being, or maybe it just seems knowledgeable because I don't know anything, but it seems like very knowledgeable and like
comfortable.
Sort of comfortable and also cautious, but like willing to go for it, in a way, which I quite like, quite like about climbing with him. Like he's not daft.
No, you know? They're playing a long game, aren't they?
Seems to make good decisions. Yeah, I think, because I've been sort of like following. He's been my sort of like partner and guide the last couple of years when we've been doing the more sort of like snow and mixed stuff.
Yeah.
I don't really know that much about all that kind of shenanigans. but it's been good to see.
And John Brace is like amazing, solid character.
Yeah, I've not done much climbing with John.
Yeah.
But he's good. I think they're a good, solid team, to be honest.
You know, like a war isn't lost on a big battle. It's always like some little tiny thing, like never enough bullets or something. It's always like those little tiny details that people. I just listened to all these podcasts about Vietnam War, like all these soldiers in Vietnam, like, you know, like now they're like 70-year-old guys talking about it. It's really interesting the things that stopped them being killed.
Yeah.
With little tiny details taking their patches off their uniforms so they couldn't tell it and they were in charge.
Yeah.
People went out with the patch and got shot immediately, or just tiny little things that you wouldn't really... I always think the way to survive as a climber is to avoid that oh shit moment where you're just like, oh shit, like when the rope whizzes through your belay device or you just realise you're not tied in or something.
Yeah.
And I think the same is with mountaineering. It's knowing all those tiny little
totally. You
know, tiny little things.
I think it's like that with any sort of it's the same with big walling. It's like it's all the small things which make it a bit.
You try and get like the whole bag off and you've clipped it with a daisy chain.
And it's just like you say, it's all the small things which then make the whole thing all a little bit easier.
And then I guess there's always that buffer zone of like just shit, incompetence, crapness, chaos that you can deal with because you know that's the game. Like on Denali this year, I was like minus 50, you know, we're up there. But I never ever remember being really, really cold.
No.
Like Vanessa got frostbite, but even she didn't feel like she ever got really, really cold but really we probably were.
Yeah.
But you just know that, oh, this is how it feels to be somewhere it's fucking freezing. You know, you can adjust for that, you know. But you never. But you know the point where you're getting so cold, you're going to get hypothermia, or you're going to get frostbite, or same on a big wall, you know when you're going to get, you know, heat stroke, or you know you're everything's going a bit out of control. Like everything's, the ropes are super tangled up, and maybe it's that thing about feeling, being able to feel shit and not feeling shit about it. Like, you know, like, I'm so shit at climbing a big wall, I just want to go back down.
Yeah.
But when the more walls you've done, you're like, oh, everything's fucking a disaster, but the way it is, you know, this is the yeah. You've seen when you're sailing around the world, all the fucking ropes, just everything's fucking disaster, you know.
Yeah.
Everything's wet and you're you know, everything else as well.
Yeah.
And what's your second thing you were saying? You got two things.
Oh, and then I have another project out in Yosemite. I'm you know, I said I met the Japanese guy.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm doing some stuff with him next year.
Oh right, oh brilliant. So, yeah, well, he seems like a super interesting.
Yeah. He's nice. I did some climbing with him this year and he's really psyched. And
that's probably one of the best things about climbing, in that you can actually hang out with really interesting people.
I just met him on the wall and then there we go, we're climbing together, and then we've got a trip next year.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's quite
good. Are you like the two most humblest men in the world? He's like,
no idea. But Japanese men are always quite.
They're
just very
deferential, and
they're like, very humble and nice people, aren't they? So
yeah. Well, keep at it.
Yeah. There we go.
And how much is your book?
How much is the book? You can get it on pre-order now, and it's £20.
Are they all signed with your sausage fingers?
The ones from Vertebra are, yeah, but not the ones in America. They're a different publisher, and I'm not over in America, so I can't sign them.
You need to have them on your website. Maybe they're shipping them out, you know.
Yeah.
Squeeze all the money out of all these punters, you know. Anyway, good talking to you. I'll now and then find a
continue. Yeah, good. Excellent. Thanks, Andy.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.